Go. Okay. This is Parshas Vayechi, but we're only going to get to the first few words of the first Rashi. It is also Asara B'Teves. Okay. And we will be speaking about both of these ideas. And we will be focusing first on not the events of Asara B'Teves, but the events of the 8th of Teves and the 9th of Teves. And in the light of those, understand the 10th of Teves. And the subject really is what was so bad about what happened on the 8th of Teves, which is the translation of Torah into Greek. And how is that associated with the 9th of Teves, which is the death of Ezra, who was also called Malachi, the last Navi, which is also associated with the siege around Jerusalem on the 10th of Teves. And how does that have to, how is that kind of predicted in the first Rashi of Vayechi? So Vayechi says, Vayechi Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim. If you look at a Sefer Torah, okay, between Parshiot, thematic segments, there are breaks, okay? Not the chapters that we have, that's totally Christian, but the Torah is divided up into thematic sections. And in between one parshia and the next is a break. Usually minimum break is nine letter spaces, and or a break where the new parshia starts on the very next line. Vayechi, Rashi tells us, if you look in the Sefer Torah, starts the next space after the last letter of Miketz. There's not even the nine spaces, nothing. It just, Miketz goes into Vayechi. And Rashi says, why is this parsha stuma? In other words, you can't see where it begins. It looks like it's a continuation. It's not differentiated. You don't have that organization where you see this is the end of one, this is the beginning of the other. It's called satum. It's really not just, it doesn't only mean not separated. Satum means blocked up, like a well, a mayan, a well spring that's blocked up with stones and dirt so the water can't escape. Or a black hole, okay, that has such an intense gravitational force that nothing can escape from it. It's, in other words, it's satum, it's blocked. The quality of it is total, is being blocked. That is the essence of it. And Rashi says, Lama Parsha Zeh Stuma? Why is this Parsha like blocked in? You don't even know where it begins. Like it can't stand on its own. It can't be differentiated. Lefi Shekevan Sheniftar Yaakov Avinu, as soon as Yaakov died, Nistumu Einehem V'Libam Shel Yisrael Mitzaras Hashibud. That's when the eyes and the heart of the Jewish people became blocked also, right? And that's because that was the beginning of the oppression. Now, a couple of things. Number one, it wasn't the deep, levels of oppression, but the beginning of their assimilation, which ultimately led to their subjugation under the Egyptians. What do we mean when we say their eyes and their heart were blocked up? Okay. Obviously, cataracts didn't grow over their eyes, and they didn't get, plaque in their arteries. It's not literal. What that means is that the job of the eyes, which is to see, and the job of the heart, which is a euphemism in Torah for the mind. This is very important. Lo sasuru achrei levavchem, v'achrei einechem. Okay. Do not go after your heart and after your eyes. Chazal tell us, that's in Parsha Tzitzis, right? Chazal tell us, achare einechem, that's your desires of your physical desires, which come from what you see, your perception, your interpretation of what you see, your subjectivity, which we've spoken about, and therefore what you want, and what you feel you need, and what you try to acquire because you see it, and you've determined that it's something, that will satisfy you. That's your eyes, and your heart, Chazal says, is your mind. That's the word Chazal used. Your ability to think clearly. Don't, be seduced by the eyes and the heart, which will tempt you to not see clearly and not think clearly. In other words, not evaluate what the world clearly through your perceptions of it, your sense perceptions, and not to know the truth of the world because your intellect is askew. It's trapped, okay? It's blocked up. So it can't tell you what you're really seeing, and you'll be misled and you will make mistakes. Okay, so don't stray after your eyes and your heart. So the eyes and the heart represent the capacities in a human being to understand the world and define it and make sense of it based on our perceptions, our sense perceptions, what we see, how things look to us, and how to make sense of the world and understand the world and hear its messages based on our intellect. To try to, we ultimately want to get to a point where what we are, what our brain is telling us is true, and not, it's not misleading us, it's not lying to us, all right? It's not telling us what we want to hear. So this begins to happen as soon as Yaakov dies, which is trying to say this, that Golos begins with the closing, so to speak, of the eyes and the mind, the blocking of the eyes and the mind, so the eyes don't tell you what, you really don't see clearly, the eyes are not telling you the truth, and your mind is not telling you the truth, and you're misreading everything, you're blocked up, okay? You can't really see what's in front of you. Now, and you can't contribute, that's a major factor. You can't function properly because you're blocked up. You are restrained, you are constrained, you can't function, right? When a well is blocked, by yesterday, it says by Yitzchak, they filled in all the wells, right? They blocked the wellspring of Mayim, which is a euphemism, again, a metaphor also for the wellsprings of Torah and truth. They blocked it. So therefore, it cannot flow. A person whose eyes and heart are blocked is restrained and limited and cannot do what they're supposed to do. So the 8th, 9th, and 10th of this month, Asar B'Tevis is today, Tanis. These three originally were all three Tanesim. We don't fast 3 days in a row, but the eighth was the translation of the Torah into Greek. It's called the Septuagint. It's famous. You could Google it. Okay, to find out more about it. It happened before the Hanukkah story, and we will talk more about it. That is considered a blockage of the light of Torah. Once it was translated into Greek, its truth, and therefore its ability to be transformative, was constrained, restrained, limited. It was this terrible, terrible, fatal limitation of Torah. And the way, therefore, the world was able to understand Torah through this version of it was, by definition, not true, not real, and did not allow the light of Torah to shine through. It was considered a tremendous tragedy, like Chet HaEgel. Okay? Tragedy is a big word. We'll speak about it more. The next day, Ezra dies. That is, he is Malachi, is the last of the Nevi'im. And the death of Ezra, Malachi, corresponds to, we associate it with, the same time period as Alexander the Great, and that is a very important time in Greek history, and we'll speak about that more also. That is the end of Nevuah. Again, a blocking of the light, that the truth that comes from spheres beyond ourselves and which can enlighten us. If that's blocked, all we have left is our own perceptions, and we've spoken about the power and the positive aspect of that, the chachma that replaces nevuah, and that's great, and that's putting the potential back into our hands to be the source of truth, right? But the dangers inherent in that, obviously, are very great. And the end of nevuah is also the beginning of the spread, so to speak, of what we call Hellenistic culture. And the third thing is the siege of Yerushalayim. That is a constraint and a limitation on the effect of Yerushalayim. And it was, you know, on the rest of the world, Yerushalayim was always the center, the light of the world, so to speak. Yafei Nof Misus Kol Haaretz. It was the source of joy for the world. It was contained, restrained. So Torah was restrained, Nevuah was restrained, Yerushalayim was restrained. That's what we're talking about. That's the beginning of Golus. Klal Yisrael start the Golus when their eyes and their mind are being restrained, correct? So far, so good? All right. Before we can speak about what a great tragedy the translation of the Torah into Greek is, we have to have a little background in the development of Greece, really, of Greece and their ideology. And we have to begin to see what we're talking about here when we talk about the Septuagint and the Greek, you know, the Greek language, which the Torah, Chazal, tell us that if the Torah would be allowed to be translated into any language, it would be Greek. It is permitted to write a Torah in Greek because Greek is the most beautiful of languages. But Rambam says that's ancient old Greek. It's not a language that the Greeks use anymore, and it wasn't the language of the Septuagint. Now, we often confuse Hellenic culture with Hellenistic culture, okay? Hellenistic culture, like where the Hanukkah story takes place, starts with Alexander the Great, Let's talk about Greece prior to that. The years we talk about Alexander, the years of Alexander are really into the 300s, early 300s or so BCE, okay? Early 300s. But if you go back a little further, back into like close to 600 BCE, you're 600 to about 300, you're talking about even earlier than 600, but that's when it really begins. You're talking about not Hellenistic culture, which begins with Alexander the Great, but Hellenic culture. Now, there's a big difference between them. The Greeks of the Hellenic period, the classical Greek period, okay, where we get Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all of that, okay, and the Greek tragedies, and Homer, all of that is in the classical Greek Hellenic period. They lived in little city-states, they governed themselves, and they shifted in those early years away from mystical, supernatural explanations for the world, you know, gods and deities and all of these mythologies, into a beginning of a search for reason, rationalization, logic, human comprehension. Now, they never were empire builders. They never were conquerors. Alexander the Great, who was not a Greek at all, comes from Macedonia, okay, was tutored by Aristotle. He's of a different sort. He has huge ambitions, one of the great megalomaniacs of history, and starts to conquer the entire world, bringing elements of Greek culture with him, but mixing it with all kinds of other influences from the, you know, Eastern, the Near East, and Africa, and all, you know, Asia Minor, all to wherever his empire ultimately extended to, influences started to penetrate. It was not pure ancient Greek Hellenic culture at all. And the Greeks were never, the original Greeks were not people to impose Xeris HaShmad, what they did to us on Hanukkah, forbidding religion. They were not brutal. They were not murderers and torturers. But the eventual, so to speak, Greece of post-Alexander, which degenerated eventually into the Roman Empire, was of a very different sort. And it was much more concerned with materialism, pleasure, power, survival of the fittest, and was not really the ancient Greek way at all. The ancient, beautiful Greek was a culture of great intelligence and great wisdom, but it did not ultimately survive in its pure form. And the question is why it degenerated, and if we begin to understand what they thought, by viewing, we're going to look at a little bit of the actual Greek tragedies, very important because they are an explanation of human nature. And you'll see how that understanding of life degenerates eventually through the Hellenistic period into the Roman period, which is not that different than Nazi Germany type of ideology, how it goes from one so beautiful to one so ugly. So the first thing is that there's a development here of ideas that are going to sound very familiar to us because Arishonim, Rambam, etc., but many use these ideas. They recognize the truth of these ideas. These ideas are our truths also. The question is the difference is not their recognition of basic truths, but their lack of knowledge of other factors that make the difference between Judaism and their ideology. So first of all, the earliest you go back to try to get a sense of what Judaism speaks about is, you know, you get in the early Greeks in period 580, essentially, Common Era, BCE, I'm sorry, before the Common Era, you have the Pythagorean theorem, you have the Pythagoreans. Now, they were mathematical in the way they thought. Math was obviously one of their great major contributions, advanced it. They saw that you could explain the world in mathematical formula, and there was a harmony to everything. And there was a beauty in that harmony. Yaf delokim liyefes, the beauty, the yofi that we ascribe to ancient Greece, is the capacity to see that all, so to speak, divergent elements really come together in one harmonious truth. Now, we speak about this. When we speak about Hashem Echad, what we're saying is that everything we see, every version and variant of existence is all, in the end, coming from one source, leading to one goal, and different expressions of one thing. Our conception of Echad, as we spoke about a long time ago by Sefiras Omer, is that there's a single, an awareness of a unity that underlies everything. And as we increase our knowledge, our perception, our individual perception of that unity expands and expands and expands until we become so enlightened that we begin to see how everything is part of the Echad. So they spoke about the Echad, and that was a major contribution to the way of thinking, because they got away from explaining the world through illogical, irrational stories and legends and, you know, and chaotic gods and battling each other. They started to see the underlying physics of the world, which is God's creation, an aspect of Hashem's wisdom, and they were awed by it, by the harmony in it all. Now that goes back, you know, this is already the time of the end of the Bayis Rishon. We haven't gotten anywhere near the Septuagint yet, which is before Hanukkah, in the Bayis Sheni. However, there was an opposite theory, okay, which came, on the tails of the Pythagoreans, and that was these are called the Heraclitus people or thinkers, and they believe that no, there's no harmony. There is an inborn tension between two forces, always competing with each other, always, Esav and Yaakov, right? Always attacking each other and counterattacking each other and vying for dominance, and no one really ever wins. And life is really more of a description, not of harmony, but of conflicting tensions, and we say the same thing. Within the harmony of the Echad, there is a battle raging between two forces, and that battle always rages, and our job, we say, is to blend them and make them into the Echad, right? Haven't we spoken about that a million times? Our job is to take the forces of what we call the heart and the mind and to put them together in harmony so that they are all devoted to one end, correct? Now, then comes a period of sophists, which we're not going to speak about. Plato didn't like them. They were people that didn't care about what was right or wrong, just the power of persuasion. But from them came Socrates, who was among the wisest of the Athenians who ever lived. And his student was Plato. We're not going to go into Socrates too much, but his student was Plato, whose student was Aristotle. Now, Plato and Aristotle are not similar on every level, but Plato spoke of way a thousand or, you know, Plato's in the year, Plato already is in the year, about 400 BCE. And so that's a good 1400 years before Rambam. And he starts to speak about terms we use all the time, Chomer and Tzura. By the way, this idea that we just spoke about, the tension between the two, is Chomer and Tzura, no question about it. And to Plato, he spoke about this. He said that because we can either perceive the world through our sense perceptions, which will deceive us, which is what we're saying, our eyes are blocked, and many people could see the same thing and have different conclusions and different interpretations. So therefore, the reality that we see with our senses or we interpret isn't the real reality. There must be an absolute truth beyond it that is real, and a person must become a philosophical person and strive to know the absolute truths that are beyond their perception. And to the extent that a person is not philosophical, they are doomed to be victims of their perception, and inevitably they will make tragic errors and tragic mistakes. So, the famous allegory of a cave, you could Google that, very important, classic, Plato's allegory of a cave, in which the people are prisoners in a cave, and there's a fire behind them, creating light. There's a puppeteer in front of the fire. Then there are the prisoners who cannot turn their heads, and they only see the wall in front of them, and the puppeteer is moving objects, which they see in shadow form, and based on what they see, they try to interpret what they're seeing, but it's not necessarily the case. They see a square box. It could be a book. It could be a box. It could be a lot of different things. They see general outlines, which doesn't necessarily mean they're seeing the reality. And he says we're all prisoners in a cave, a person, an unphilosophical person, who does not strive to get past the way they see things based on their limited subjective view is a prisoner in a cave who is definitely going to make fatal errors, either because they don't know what they're seeing, or they've blinded themselves by some character flaw that they've justified so that they call a mountain a pit and a pit a mountain, or they refuse to see the mountain in front of them completely. So now, this, by the way, the Ramchal talks about Choshech. Choshech is Greece. Okay, we're going to speak about the Greece of Hanukkah and the Greece of the Septuagint. But when the Ramchal says Choshech, because you think Greece, we always think of Greece as so enlightened, but there was a fatal flaw in their thinking, in not all of their thinking, but what ultimately became, you know, the result of it. Ramchal says, talking about Choshech, hold it, where are we? In Mesilas Yesharim, the darkness can cause two types of errors to the eye of man. Okay, where does darkness come from? Darkness is another way of saying evaluating things by what we see, our eyes, our subjectivity, our ego, how we want to interpret things to serve our needs, to give us pleasure, to gratify us the way we see things, okay? That's blindness. That's after the Eitz Hadas, which is a euphemism for subjectivity. Eating from the Eitz Hadas is allowing oneself to become subjective. Their eyes open. But Rambam says in the very beginning of Mor Nevuchim, don't think, first of all, that their eyes were closed, like with a seal together and sewn together, now they open. That's number one. Number two, don't think the opening, even in a philosophical sense, means some positive increase in perception. It's the opposite. Eyes opening means now they see everything from their eyes, which is going to fool them and mislead them because it's based on what they know. And they're, you know, you can only interpret something based on your limited range of knowledge. You know, if you don't know much, so what you see, you got to kind of try to fit it into one category. You go, it's based on, it's totally kidnapped by, it's subject to the limitations of what we know. So opening the eyes is actually a disaster, right? So Choshech is another way of saying the opening of the eyes. It's another form of, it's Choshech. It's real darkness in the true sense. And the Ramchal says that the darkness can cause two types of errors. Either one can cover, it can cover the eye and prevent someone from seeing what is right before them altogether. Or it can mislead him so that he calls a pillar a man and a man a pillar. Yehuda and Yosef, right? We've spoken about this a lot. We did this last week, right? The shift from subjectivity to objectivity. He is standing in front of Yosef. Everything has come true. Everything was exactly what it should be. Yaakov preferred Yosef and was grooming him for Malchus because Yosef and Ephraim from Yosef would ultimately always be the leaders of the Jewish people in times of Gullus. And Yosef's dreams were true. And they'd all just bow down to Yosef. And not only that, they were in the midst of believing at that moment, standing in front of Yosef, that this was the deepest, darkest tragedy, the pit. This was disaster was looming. There was no disaster looming. All 12 brothers were reunited. It would be a short moment before they'd know they were reunited. Then Yaakov would come down. There was no tragedy at all. There was no danger at all. That everything that they couldn't believe could come true had come true. And yet, at that moment, as we said, Yehuda standing in front of Yosef, till he made that speech, did not see anything that was right before his eyes. Why? His mind, which is supposed to be a device created to tell you, give you information. Of course, obviously, the information right in front of you, that a book is a book. I mean, that's the basics of mind has to do. Tell you when it's night and when it's day, right? The mind is a device that's supposed to give you information. And yet Yehuda's mind could not give him the most basic, simple information that was right in front of his face, that this was Yosef and everything was true. All right, and there was no tragedy because of why? Because it was trapped, it was besieged, it was closed up, it was blocked by what? His perception of things. Where does his perception of things come from? His sense of self. From what does that come from? Jealousy, character flaw, ego, right? So what happens in that speech? That speech shows us that he had made that long journey, huge journey. It's the hardest journey to make between subjectivity and objectivity. And his objectivity came through when he said to Yosef, look, there is a fact. This is a fact. Okay? Yaakov loves Binyamin, period. They're intertwined. Their souls are intertwined. And because that's the reality, and what I how I relate to it is completely irrelevant, because that's the reality, I have pledged my life in this world and the next world to make sure that they are not separated. End of story. In other words, there that was his that was a speech expressing his total objectivity. Once he removes himself and his subjective opinion, his need to interpret the world based on his perceptions and his needs and his desires, the mind, which is supposed to give him information but is trapped and besieged, now is freed from the trap, the prison, the cave that we are prisoners in, and now it gives him all the information in one split second. Yosef doesn't really say anything. He says, by the way, nothing. He just says, I'm Yosef. He doesn't explain anything. He says, by the way, you know, I'm here. In other words, all of a sudden, what was always there, because he is no longer objective, a subjective, bursts upon his consciousness in total clarity. The whole picture, going back now 25, 27, 30 years, whatever it was, way to the beginning. Now he can see what's right in front of his face. Now his mind can do its job and give him information, because he's released it from the prison, from the cave, from the trap. So they understood this. Plato said that a person who is not philosophical and is captured by his own perceptions is doomed to make fatal errors. The Ramchal says either he will cover his eyes and he will not see what is in front of him, or he will see what's in front of him and call it something else, call a pillar a man. Reinterpret it according to his needs, his subjectivity. So they understood this. Okay, based on this idea, we come to take a look into Greek tragedy to understand why Greece is choshech and we are or. So according to this this Platonic idea, and Aristotle, by the way, differed from Plato in many areas. By the way, Rambam held very much of Aristotle. He called him the wisest man, you know, ever, except he disagreed with him very strongly in the areas that you might say that Aristotle disagreed with Plato. Because Plato believed in the idea that you have to be philosophical, but you also have to know that there is more to what you than what you see. Whereas Aristotle was convinced that only what you see is the reality, and he did not believe in Nisim, Nevuah, the chosenness of Klal Yisrael, that Hashem was beyond the world. He didn't believe in any of that, and there Rambam takes great issue with him. But only what you can see and quantify, whereas Plato did not believe that. He did believe in forms, tzura, that was beyond what you could see. Now, this idea, which is Aristotle, which was Alexander the Great, he's Alexander the Great's teacher, which becomes eventually Hellenistic culture, is described beautifully in the Greek tragedies, which Aristotle himself explains the nature of what a Greek tragedy is in one of his works, which, by the way, he didn't write, but his students wrote about, you know, from his teachings called Poetics. And now he talks about this. This is an interesting idea. Because remember, Aristotle said, only what you see and can quantify and measure is the reality. If that's the case, then as Plato said, you are going to make a mistake, because the fact is that we don't see everything. And we are ignorant of certain things that are beyond their knowledge. It is not true that only what you see and measure is the reality. That's you know, we know that's not true. And the Kabbalistic schools obviously were very much at odds with this type of idea, and the whole thrust is to show us what we're not really seeing, which changes everything for us. Once you see what's really going on, you relate to it very differently, right? Once a light bulb goes on. So in a Greek tragedy, there is a concept called hamartia. Anyone familiar with this? From college? No? Hamartia. That is the tragic flaw or the tragic error that is inevitable and will cause the hero total catastrophe and disaster. The Greeks did not see tsunamis and mudslides and hurricanes as tragic, because they had no way to control it. It was out of their hands. It was God's department, and they didn't get involved with it. Just like us, by the way. We don't have much to say about that. They did not deal with the suffering of the innocent. Again, it was incomprehensible. And the same with us in Iov. We don't really have an answer. What they dealt with and what we deal with too is the human being and their human nature and the attempt to elevate human nature, but the inevitable, as we spoke about, tension with core basic animalistic human nature, and the struggle in a person to kind of be better, improve, achieve great things, and the inevitable obstacles in their path which will cause them to stumble. So the two classic like examples of these two forces, the force to be, what they recognize, this is, Aristotle speaks about the tragedy, so this is already prior to him. What they recognize is that in every human being, because they're gods, by the way, the Greeks had endless gods, right? But their gods were basically every aspect of human nature that could be understood, that they understood, and they were very good at understanding human nature, was given a name and a face and called a god, okay? So they had two gods that described these two forces, Tzur and Chomer, that were always at odds with each other, which Judaism says can be harmonized, but in the tragedies they were not harmonized. So what were the two gods? There was Apollo. Apollo was the most beautiful, the most perfect. He represents wisdom and good judgment and all the good character traits and moral purity and mental purity and elevation over the basic animal self, and transcendence over the urges and the reactions, all the good things. Tzura, what we call Tzura, more of a Tzelem Elokim, is Apollo. His nemesis, so to speak, half-brother, was Dionysus. Dionysus is the god of wine and women and song, Chomer, and Dionysus represents the chaotic surrender to the gut desires. Okay, by the way, I Googled this a little bit. The one who made a study of the tension between Apollo and Dionysus is Nietzsche, famous. He wrote The Birth of Tragedy, among other things. And he explains Greek tragedies as this constant tension. And the way he explains Dionysus is the following. Dionysic stirrings arise either through the influence of those narcotic potions, you know, wine, he was known for wine, of which all primitive races speak in their hymns, or through the powerful approach of spring, which penetrates with joy the whole frame of nature. So stirred, the individual forgets about himself completely. For a brief moment, we become ourselves, the primal being, and we experience our insatiable hunger for existence. Now we see the struggle, the pain, the destruction of appearances. And he starts speaking about, we feel this immense lust and desire and passion to just surrender to the drives, the instincts, the chaos, the drunken revelry that this god is known for. That's the human nature of a person, to seek tangible, immediate forms of gratification. Dionysus is the god of gratification, where Apollo is the god of self-restraint. Now, what happens is, in the tragedies, there's always the attempt of the hero to be noble or to be great or do the right thing. But through a tragic flaw or tragic error called hamartia, they will stumble over an obstacle and they will fail. And the obstacles are put there by fate, by nature itself. This is also very much of like Aristotelian, because Aristotle explains the tragedies that in the end, it is based on the ultimate misfortune and catastrophe of a noble person. And that brought out pity and fear in the audience that it could happen to us, and pity for the misfortune. But it also brought out a awareness that the tragic flaw or the tragic error was a product of some type of ignorance. And when that tragic error takes place and it becomes clear, the ignorance becomes knowledge, and that was like the pleasure of the tragedy. So for example, when we talk about the tragic flaw, it could either be either a character flaw, mostly in their tragedies was hubris, ego, arrogance, that made you, again, not see what was right in front of you, not make the right decision, make a miscalculation, which will bring a catastrophe upon everybody, okay? Or it wasn't a character flaw, it was a predestined, inevitable flaw that you had to make because of your ignorance, because you just didn't know the big picture, like Oedipus kills his father, because he doesn't know that it's his father. And nobody could have solved that. There was no way for him to know. So he kills him. So in other words, fate has determined that you will make a mistake because of ignorance. This is what the Ramchal is talking about, the darkness. There is reality. There is ignorance that comes from not knowing. And then there's also character flaws, which is self-imposed ignorance. Either one of these are doomed to mess you up, and that you will make a mistake based on your... The error will be made because of lack of character development and self-control, or because you just were in a trap. There was a trap put in front of you by the reality. Now, when Aristotle talks about the idea that everything is knowable, obviously the tragedy is that, you know, not everything is knowable, and that's why you will make certain mistakes. There are realities out there that you can't know. So you're doomed. You're doomed, and that's why it's called the tragedy. Now, that is Choshech, because it is true that there is the Apollos type of aspirations of man, what we call the Tzelem Elokim. It is true there is the Chomer, the Dionysic type of, you know, natural gut reactions of man. But it is not true that in the end your surrender to your fatal, tragic flaw, which is your ego or your moral flaw or your ignorance, will inevitably destroy you. The Jews say, yes, it's true. We know that we can't know everything. And we know that we have a human nature that is so powerful, it always tries to drag us down, and it always clouds our thinking, and that's called gullus. And then we react subjectively, and we make stupid, horrible, catastrophic mistakes based on that, exactly. But our God is not, like Aristotle thought, human nature itself, a sum total of nature, and not beyond nature, but whatever the nature is, whatever the rules were, that is God. We have a God that is beyond that, which means our God will interfere, and he will open your eyes, pokeach ivrim, so you won't fall in the pit, and you won't make the fatal error. And he will be a bal chesed, and he'll, if he sees you trying to improve yourself, he will not trip you up. We have a halacha, a mitzvah, lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. That's the exact opposite of what they thought. Lifnei iver lo sitein michshol means do not put a stumbling block in front of another person. In other words, if they're trying, of course we're limited. Of course we sometimes can't. We try to do the right thing, but there are factors, you know, beyond our control that might hinder us. But we say, just like Hashem removes stumbling blocks to help you get to where you're going with Rachmanus, we don't put stumbling blocks in front of people. When we call Hashem in the first bracha of Shmoneh Esrei, Mogein Avraham, what does shield mean? Shield you from your blindness and the mistakes you could make and the pitfalls because of human ignorance. If you try it yourself to the best that you can to remove yourself, as we spoke about last week, from your own interpretations and try to attach yourself, achieve chachma and objectivity, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to come to your aid. That's a major, major, huge difference, because we have a HaKadosh Baruch Hu that is not, you know, condemned to be, you know, work only according to the rules of what human beings, you know, can know and can understand and choices we can make. Hashem interferes and remove, like we say, pokeach ivrim, opens your eyes, right? Rofe cholim, heals the sick emotionally. I mean, you know, refuas hanefesh, when we're sick because we have a cataract, so to speak, over our eyes and over our hearts because that we've imposed. But here's the thing. The job of the human being is to start the process of, like we spoke about last week, choresh and kotzer, Yehuda and Yosef, right? The human being has to prepare the earth to receive the seed. We don't, once that seed is put in the earth, we just kind of stand back, and it has this magical, mysterious, metaphysical, like, chachma grows into wheat. We don't do that. We just prepare the earth, and the chachma now has a place to grow from. Preparing the earth means we become more removed from ourselves. We start looking at the bigger picture. We stop evaluating everything based on how we see it. That allows the seed of chachma, which is always compared to chita, right? We've spoken about this too, wheat and chachma and das, starts to grow. Wisdom can start to increase in a person. That's already the beginning of geula, so to speak. And all of a sudden a person can be filled with true, with light and understanding, because they've taken themselves out of the picture, and like they can start to see what's really emes, and they start to learn Torah and all types of learning. Rambam was a huge advocate for contemplation, to start learning about the world around you, because it's so mind-boggling. It's awe-inspiring that when you see the Bria that Hashem created and the harmony in it all, the positive and negative forces and yet the oneness of all of it, and you see it on a macro level and a micro level, and you start to learn a little about physics, it's mind-boggling, and you step back in awe, which Rambam calls yira, not fear of punishment, but awe, yiras haromimus, and you start realizing that, okay, so if I don't understand the circumstances of my particular life, it's not such a tragedy because I'm in good hands. I'm in very good hands. So you have to see the bigger picture. And you go into that type of philosophy. And by the way, Kabbalah is just spiritual physics, telling you also what's beneath the surface. And I don't mean the hocus, you know, kind of Kabbalah, but the philosophical Kabbalah that the, you know, Maharal and the Ramchal and Mashpira in our day speaks of, these type of things, the Vilna Gaon, the philosophical, telling you what's going on beneath the surface, giving you a bigger picture. Then you stand back and you reserve judgment based on your own perceptions. That's the beginning of what's called Geula. That's Geula. But in the end, what has to happen is there's always this tension. As long as the wheat is growing in the dirt, right? The chachma is sharing the same place, so to speak, or growing out of the raw material, which is us. There's always that danger that what can happen? You know, if the earth is hard and dry and not cultivated, the seeds won't grow, right? And even once you put a seed in and it starts to grow, it's not a guaranteed process, right? It could be, if you don't water it, you don't keep the earth fertile, it will become hard like stone and nothing, and you know, your crop won't yield much. In other words, what that's trying to say is there's always going to be a tension between me making space for real chachma, you know, keeping myself a little bit at bay, and then the assertion of myself and my, you know, my instant reactions and my perceptions, my interpretations, the blindness. So what does Yosef come to do? Remember, the koach of Yosef is, what was Yosef? We said it last week. The reaper. What does the reaper do? Cuts it. Remember? That cutting is the metaphor for allowing the koach of the mind. We read the Rambam last week, right? I gave it out. Letting the mind, which was created to not be trapped in the cave and not be a device to give you the interpretations you need and not be kidnapped by the self, right? It allows the mind to go and do what it's supposed to do, which is start to be a receptacle, absorb the R and the Chachma and the light of real truth, which then comes back. Once we cut it, we eat it, it comes back to allow the person to fully function with energy. So the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual all are unified, all enlightened by true Chachma, which is now allowed to increase and expand because it's disconnected. It's now no longer in Gullus. It's no longer in the cave. It's no longer trapped. And therefore, it can increase and expand and come back. We eat it, so to speak, and that means we now are transformed, and that what we want and what we love and what we devote our physical energies to and what governs us and guides us and explains things to us is more truth, and it's not based on only what we see. That's the whole difference. We cut it from us. Yosef is the kotzer, is the opposite of this idea, this aspect of Greek philosophy, that you can only know what you can see and what you can measure. That's be cut from the self, and then it can develop. Now, later, after Aristotle, was Alexander the Great, and after Alexander the Great's empire, after he died, his empire was divided, and then one of the portions of his empire was governed by Ptolemy from Egypt, okay, Greek culture in Egypt, but it was already influenced by other cultures. And anyway, by Ptolemy II, Philadelphus, he started this project of translating the Torah into Greek, but as Rambam says, not the ancient Greek, which is the beauty of Greek, but the newer version of Greece, which is influenced by what the mistakes, so to speak, of Alexander's teacher, which is that it is what you can quantify. Okay, translating the Torah into that kind of language, you see the problem. That isn't the Torah. That's Choshech instead of R. The Torah becomes constrained and limited. It is not what the Torah is, the seed planted in the earth. We prepare the earth. The Torah is the Chachma, but it takes us into a different realm if we allow the Torah to exist, the truth, to exist outside of ourselves in its own, it's untouched, pure and untainted by our trapping of it in our perceptions, right? It has to be beyond the person. That to keep it within the understanding of the person is to mutilate it, right? That's the translation I'm throwing into Greek. It has also such a tragedy, a real Jewish tragedy, and mourned it and created a fast day for it. And interestingly enough, as we said, Malachi Ezra dies on the 9th of Tevis, which is concurrent with Alexander the Great's, conquest of either Israel or the Near East. And that's the end of Nevuah, which is another aspect of the same thing. And then, of course, you have the, as we said, the siege of Yerushalayim, which is constraining that. Now, but we always said that the Golos, which allows man's Chachma to be the source of Isarusa Delatata, right? Inspiration and truth, means that man's Chachma has the capacity to arrive at all those truths that in the previous Tkufa, era, Hashem revealed to us from heaven, which is man's mind can come to know truth, can be saved from the tragic flaw of ignorance, because man's mind, man's ability to know MS is very much a power, a gift that Hashem has given us that can work, provided it is not reduced to, held back by my interpretations. The chachma of a person can be so great, the chachma of Torah can emerge from us, and it come to understand and to grasp things that are way beyond us, which then come back to enlighten us. Human chachma can get past the self and the way we see things, and it could go into the realms of the real, absolute truth, the realms of pure, what we call Orais, the Torah comes from the word of light. But that comes, the only way a person, let's say it this way, the person doesn't create the truth of Torah. The person is not the source of it. The only job a person has to do, and this is where Hashem helps us and does not put a stumbling block in our path, if we try, yagatu matzasa, if you try, you will succeed, is to make ourselves prepared to have Torah and art and light and truth grow within us. And that ultimate preparation is when we manage, sometimes only for short episodes and sometimes in certain areas, to disconnect, truth from the way we want to interpret it. In other words, we'll hold ourselves back, get to a point of which we call a level of geula, freedom, liberation from what? The darkness, the siege that we have put around our mind. And by the way, it's not just a siege around our mind. With this, we're going to end. When the person functions based on their interpretations, they are the center, okay? Then not only is the mind trapped in a prison and it can't tell you the facts and can't give you any light and it can't change you and it can't transform you and it can't ennoble you, the body is trapped. It has to serve the needs for the gratification of the ego. So, for example, let's talk about eating. You see Nebuch, people walking around whose bodies are like battlefields of neglect and abuse, right? How does a person get to that point? Because the sensory stimulation, the gratification, what I want now because I'm the center and there's nothing beyond me and my needs, is so powerful that they have a certain taste, which, by the way, goes from here, 1.5 inches back maybe. That's it. Okay. After that, there's no more pleasure. But the taste is and the instant gratification of that moment is more important to me, which is total blindness, that although I know that this that I'm eating is full of chemicals that will poison me, it doesn't mean a thing to me. My brain is, can tell me it, but it can't impress it upon me. It's zero. And I go and I eat this, and then people really abuse or trap their bodies in being servants of this, prisoners to this need for gratification. And the body is not meant to be abused like that. It has a function. We're not letting the mind do what it's supposed to do. And we don't let the body do it, so you can't run, you can't walk, can't breathe, can't see. We're not allowing the body to do what it's supposed to do. It's trapped by our need for having things when we want them at this moment because we want them, period. So everything is trapped. So what, by the way, and we end with this idea, what, by the way, constantly, the Yetzirah, by the Satan, the Nachash, by the Eitz Hadas, which is the same thing, by the way, of the Dionysic type of God, says there's pleasure and freedom and total and surrender to desire, the body's wants, because your physical body, your intellect, your emotions, all will be harmonized in surrender to your desires. It sounds so good in the moment, and it feels so good in the moment, but that abuse of the mind and the body, you see what it looks like a few years later. We see it. It looks, it's so ugly. It's horrifying. It's tragic in a way that gives us a sense of fear. That's what happens. So what we're saying here is that gullus is associated with the blocking, and we put ourselves into our own gullus by our, we allow ourselves to be more and more deeply in gullus. It's the blocking of our eyes, the Rashi says. That means how we perceive things with our senses and what we want, and blocking of our mind. Our mind is trapped. And that is the beginning of gullus and exists on many levels. Yerushalayim is in gullus. Its besiege is constrained. In other words, our national lifestyle can't radiate the aura that it's supposed to, because it's deteriorated into self-servingness, selfishness, whatever it is. We started doing the great averus, the great sins, and the Torah is trapped. Wisdom is trapped, right? And as we said, divine revelation is trapped. And to the extent that a person frees themselves, they begin to be able to function, to contribute, to gain knowledge, to get closer and closer to Rambam says, not to real nevuah, but to the degree that a person perfects themselves and allows their mind to do what it's supposed to do, they get levels of divine providence, he calls, which is Ruach HaKodesh, and inspiration and glimpses of the truth and kind of like revelations and chidushim, and insights and epiphanies that comes to a person. If they do the work of preparing the soil, so to speak, and allowing this to happen. Okay. Any questions?
No.